We'll now move to the second case on our calendar this morning. That is In Re Tronix. Mr. Haddad, are you here?
Yes, Your Honor.
You can see and hear me in the panel all right?
Yes, I can.
Good. And Mr. Johnson?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good. All right. I can see you loud and clear and hear you loud and clear. So great. So you've each got 10 minutes. Mr. Haddad, you've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. The floor is yours. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Richard Haddad, for the plaintiff Stanley Waleski, who sues on his own behalf and on behalf of 4,300 similarly situated individuals and decedents' estates. We ask that the lower court's orders denying remand be vacated and that this action be remanded to the Luzerne County, Pennsylvania court. And that is because there's no federal question jurisdiction over this Pennsylvania state law case between Pennsylvania residents concerning a contract entered into and executed in Pennsylvania and admittedly governed by Pennsylvania law.
Mr. Haddad, when you say there's no federal jurisdiction, are you saying there's not even related to non-core jurisdiction? Are you saying that, yes, there is non-core jurisdiction, but then it would be subject to mandatory abstention?
Well, we were actually going to make that argument below, but the defendant who initially suggested in their removal petition that it was related to jurisdiction actually abandoned that argument. And therefore, if there were not arguing and there was no related to jurisdiction, the mandatory abstention prongs did not come into play. So the only basis for jurisdiction that's asserted here and which was found below is arising in jurisdiction. And the reason why arising in jurisdiction fails is because this is a case between two non-bankruptcy estate parties. It's not brought by or against the debtor or the estate. It does not affect, and it cannot affect, and that's critical, it cannot affect the debtor or the estate. It does not involve a professional whose fee for representing Mr. Waleski was paid by the debtor or paid by the estate. It does not involve the type of claim or case that could exist only in bankruptcy, like a bankruptcy preference, for example. It does not relate to a still pending bankruptcy.
It relates to claims that counsel that was retained by the plaintiff or plaintiff's class didn't do what they were supposed to do in the bankruptcy.
That would be the case in any malpractice case.
Well, except that when they participated, they had someone put on the committee of creditors and ultimately a distribution scheme was approved. There was an opportunity to object to that distribution scheme as to whether it was fair and inequitable. And yet you seek to relitigate that it was unfair to your clients in state court. How is that not second guessing an existing bankruptcy proceeding and arise out of the bankruptcy proceeding?
For several reasons. Number one, the fact that the attorney got involved with the representing of a member of the creditors committee is itself a breach, because that breached the contract pursuant to which the law firm agreed to represent Mr. Waleski, not to be the attorney for the situation.
Conflict between one of the tort plaintiffs and the rest who's on the committee and the rest of the tort plaintiffs? Don't they all have the identical interests?
No, they don't. And here's the factual reason, which would be explored
in discovery. That would seem to be a reason why Mr. Waleski would seek in the bankruptcy not to be treated in the same class with all the others. All the other vocal plaintiffs.
Right. And those are issues.
Why didn't he object in the bankruptcy and free himself of that settlement?
Because his lawyers were on the wrong side of the case.
He was capable of having another lawyer, wasn't he? He has one now.
But he does have one now. But at the time when you have an attorney and that attorney seeks to take on a conflicting representation, it's the attorney's obligation to advise the client of the conflict and leave it to the client to decide whether to waive the conflict or perhaps to participate in that proceeding. None of this was done here.
Let me ask you this. How is he conflicted? How is your client's claim different from the other Avoca plaintiffs?
Because my client's claim is the same as the Avoca plaintiffs. My client's claim is different from other state plaintiffs.
Wait a second. Now that you've told me that, then it's the whole class of Avoca plaintiffs who were wronged by this lawyer.
Yes, and that's the basis upon which our
claim is brought. And that would be clearly an exquisite ground to object to in bankruptcy court that the settlement should not be approved. That happens all the time, counsel.
Yes, but usually your lawyer is not the guy or person who is preparing the improper statement, who has breached its duty to represent Mr. Rolesky and the class plaintiffs exclusively.
Mr. Haddad.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Haddad, isn't your point that whatever happens in the Pennsylvania case, if it proceeds, is not going to have any impact on the bankruptcy estate or what's been paid out or anything? It's all going to come out of the lawyer's pocket, right?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. It does not challenge the bankruptcy plan, the estate, the releases, the claims, the distributions, or the orders or settlements, or the outcome of the bankruptcy case. Those are done. Those are final.
Doesn't it claim that the settlement as to the Evoca plaintiffs was unfair to them?
The claim is a breach of contract claim.
Oh, just answer my question. Doesn't it claim that the settlement in bankruptcy court as to the Evoca plaintiffs was unfair to them?
Resulting from the plaintiff's breach, from the defendant's breach. Yes.
I take that to be a yes.
Yes, Your Honor. And here's
let me ask you a question then. How does that not call into question the bankruptcy court's approval of the settlement?
Because, Your Honor, there's five or six different breaches, but in particular, in any instance, under Your Honor's statement or your question, in any instance in which a client wished to sue its attorney in connection with a bankruptcy case, you would say, well, then it must be related. It must be arising in jurisdiction.
Not necessarily, but you're going the other way. You're going the other way on that. You're saying that as long as the money isn't coming out of the bankruptcy estate, there's a hard and fast rule that says it doesn't arise in the bankruptcy case. And it's almost like a Rooker-Feldman analysis, isn't it? It's like if the state court judgment would impugn the integrity of the bankruptcy process, even if it doesn't cost the holders of the estate or the estate itself any money, isn't that something that arose in the bankruptcy case?
No, because it does not impugn the integrity at all. Those orders are done, final, and they're finished. And the Supreme Court in the Gunn case, and it was patent jurisdiction, so it's analogous, that the Supreme Court said it does not impact those federal court rulings because those rulings are those rulings, and it's the state that has the particular interest in governing the issues of between an attorney and its client and regulating attorneys' conduct. In the extended stay case, Judge Laura Taylor Swain wrote about referencing this court's decision in the Baker case and said that arising in jurisdiction of a professional malpractice case turns on court appointment of the professional and the interrelationship of the alleged malpractice with the court's supervision of the professional and the integrity of the administration of the case.
Well, let me stop you there. I mean, we understand all that, but I mean, it seems to me your real point is that any malpractice case is alleging that what ultimately happened in whatever proceeding, a bankruptcy court or a district court or a state court, was the wrong result.
But
we don't usually say that that impugns the integrity of the judgment that got issued.
Right, and we're not, correct, Your Honor, and we're not saying that. And nor does it automatically go back to that original judge who may or may not have views on what occurred. No one is questioning or challenging what the bankruptcy judge actually did. The questions and challenges here are with respect to whether this plaintiff breached its contract to its client. And that context, we see a distinction, and we ask this court to enter an order consistent with what Judge Laura Taylor Swain wrote in the extended stay case.
Mr. Haddad, Judge Sullivan will just indulge me for one more question. I just want to say, isn't there a distinction between a creditor who's injured by malpractice in the bankruptcy court and doesn't get his $100 or his $1,000 or his $100,000 or his $1 million and 4,300 plaintiffs who are treated differently? And it totally impugns the integrity of the bankruptcy process, even though it doesn't cost the estate anything. Isn't there a difference there?
No. First of all, the case is whether you're one plaintiff or 4,300 plaintiffs. From a jurisdictional perspective, that makes no difference. And secondly, the one or the 4,300 people are not impugning the integrity of the bankruptcy case. They are saying that this lawyer, that these attorneys breached their written contract to represent us and only us. And for that, the case, there should be no federal jurisdiction. and the case should be remanded to the Pennsylvania State Court.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. You've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. We'll now hear from Mr. Johnson. It sounds like Mr. Haddad is impugning the integrity or certainly ability of your clients. Whether he's also impugning the integrity of the court is one we'll pick up with you. So, Mr. Johnson, you may be.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Robert Johnson, and I have the privilege of representing the appellees in this case, the law firm of Montgomery McCracken, Walker & Rhodes, and its then partners, Natalie Ramsey and Leonard Busby. And starting with that point, Your Honor, the appellant's claim that there is no bankruptcy court jurisdiction unfortunately turns on an extraordinarily form over substance constricted reading of what constitutes arising in jurisdiction. Instead of doing what Baker versus Simpson and its progeny and courts in other circuits have focused on, which is the function of the alleged wrongdoer and the effect of that wrongdoer's work on the bankruptcy estate, the appellant is asking the court to focus strictly on the form of whether the defendant was court appointed, which is not the language that all of these opinions use, and is attempting to totally ignore my client's role in this case. The appellant also ignores the recognition that this court made even prior to controlling precedent in Baker v. Simpson, that Congress intended to define core bankruptcy proceedings as expansively as possible. Instead of acknowledging that expansive jurisdiction, the appellant is asking the court to construe narrowly, which is not permitted by any of the binding or persuasive precedent. And I find it interesting that, in an effort to hide from congressional intent that core proceedings be defined broadly, the appellant spent 5 pages in its opening brief focusing on completely irrelevant non-bankruptcy precedent, and even spent part of the precious 8 minutes that the court provided to him to talk about a patent case, never having explained to the court why patent law is analogous and why this panel should look at that when there is plenty of bankruptcy jurisdiction law from this circuit, from the district courts in this circuit, and from other circuits that are consistent with Baker v. Simpson, and then went on at length in the brief to discuss just general federal claims.
Mr. Johnson, I need to ask you a practical question. I understand the parties have not litigated what would happen if there was no arising in jurisdiction. I suppose one thing we could do is we could dismiss the case outright. But if, in fact, there is related to non-core jurisdiction, we'd probably have to remand. I don't think we'd dismiss for lack of jurisdiction when there may well be a basis at this stage of the case. We'd have to remand to the district court, and maybe the district court would remand to the bankruptcy court to determine what the effect of the related to jurisdiction is. And what would happen there? Isn't it clear that there's related to jurisdiction, if nothing else?
Well,
I don't think we can avoid that question because it's a subject matter jurisdiction question, even though the parties have not litigated it.
Judge Kogan, you're correct that absolutely at a minimum there would be related to jurisdiction. However, on a remand, that would then be subject to a mandatory abstention analysis, and most likely the result there would be that whether it was the district court or back down to the bankruptcy court would have to conclude, yes, there is relating to jurisdiction, but mandatory abstention applies. There are very few exceptions to that. The reality, however, is the reason why that hasn't been briefed on the district court or circuit court level is because it's abundantly clear that there is arising in jurisdiction. So I think as a procedural step, you would have to remand first within the federal system, and it would be to the district court, but the court need never get to that step. And the reason for it is because the precedent in this circuit and persuasive precedent in others indicates that when you have a defendant that has the substantial level of effect on the administration of the bankruptcy that my client undisputedly did, as demonstrated by the allegations of the complaint and the amended complaint, It clearly impacts the integrity of the bankruptcy process and thus is subject to arising in jurisdiction. And
why do you say that? So it's not clear to me why it impacts the integrity of the bankruptcy system any more than malpractice in a contract case impugns the integrity of a district court or a commercial division court that resolved a case against a plaintiff.
Very simple, Judge Sullivan. The reason for that is because the conduct of my client, which is now suddenly after getting Mr. Haddad's clients over $130 million, that wasn't simply directed to those clients. It was directed to the creation of the Tort Claims Trust, which accounted for 12%, $683 million of the largest asset in the bankruptcy estate.
Okay, but malpractices in a commercial case will be responsible for 100% of the award or lack of award. So why does the court not get a black eye in the general malpractice case? We don't worry about it. I mean, if you do a lousy job here and they bring a malpractice action against you, I'm not going to lose a lot of sleep over it. That's just the way it goes. So why is the bankruptcy court different?
Because, Your Honor, in the standard commercial situation, the only party that is impacted by that malpractice is the client. That's not the case that you have here, because my client's alleged wrongdoing didn't simply impact the 4,300 Avoca plaintiffs. It impacted the entire distribution scheme for that $683 million that was allocated.
For the better, right? I mean, as far as those other parties are concerned, they did better because your client did such a bad job for his own clients, right?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but arguably that still impacts the integrity of the process, because if the argument is that the Mr. Walesky and his colleagues were unduly affected, that means that somebody recovered from the bankruptcy estate when it shouldn't. And this falls squarely, basically what they're saying is my client was so incompetent that Judge Gropper and then Judge Wiles on the bankruptcy court messed up the process. And that's completely consistent with other cases, including Baker v. Simpson, which was filed after the bankruptcy was closed, clearly was not going to affect distribution of funds because they had already been distributed.
The difference, of course, is, and this is the point Mr. Haddad makes, is that in Baker, it's the court that appointed this lawyer. So yeah, you might get a black eye when you pick the lawyer and that lawyer turned out to be ineffective.
Well, Your Honor, let's take a look at the allegations of the complaint then with regard to my client. I mean, first and foremost, of course, and the appellant wants to run away from it, paragraph 53 of the complaint alleges that my client was court approved. And as a matter of fact, while they're trying to run away from that, that's true. As Judge Wesley noted during Mr. Haddad's argument, there is, you don't get on the unsecured creditors committee without approval, but it goes beyond that. As alleged in the complaint, in the amended complaint, my client actually was paid out of debtor assets. My client was awarded a $200,000 fee in the form of a substantial contribution award. Why were they awarded that? Because unlike the kind of claim that appellant's counsel wants this court to analogize the current situation to, in this situation, my client's work is alleged to have actually been adopted into the confirmed plan. And in fact, it was, because part of the plan confirmation was the establishment of the Tort Claims Trust, which the allegations of the complaint say my client wrote, and the trust distribution procedures, which are the basis for a specific claim of malpractice in this case. So I think, I'm sorry, Judge.
Isn't that the difference? If you had a malpractice claim against a lawyer in a bankruptcy by a creditor because they failed to file a claim such that you got cut out and didn't get paid, that doesn't go to the actual, to the bankruptcy itself and how it functions. You've got a claim against the lawyer because he or she didn't file the claim. But this goes to the entire functioning and the administration of the bankruptcy estate, That's, I mean, this guy was, they represented on the credit on the, on the unsecured creditors committee, and their claims really run contrary to prove malpractice would run contrary to the findings by the district court or by the bankruptcy court with regard to the fairness and the equitableness of the distributions, wouldn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly.
They're going to have to prove that their claims are different from the Mississippi plaintiffs. And they claim that by including the Mississippi, so they have to specifically undercut a core determination that legitimized the distribution of them as one class, wouldn't they?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. And that is the difference, because what the appellant's arguing is something that would overrule a specific order of the bankruptcy judge with regard to the eligibility of the Mississippi claimant. So this is not a situation in which somebody forgot to file a proof of claim. It is one where the impact of the alleged wrongdoing affected distribution to several thousand, possibly tens of thousands of claimants in the bankruptcy.
So Mr. Johnson, you've raised another point I haven't thought of, which is as much as it impugns that, the substantial contribution order, it completely eviscerates, right? I mean, I didn't realize there was a substantial contribution order approving fees to your client. But with that, how can a malpractice verdict be consistent with the bankruptcy court's finding there?
I would agree, Your Honor, because that's a situation where you are saying to a bankruptcy court judge who was impressed enough with my client's work to not only incorporate it into the confirmed plan, but to also award funds from the debtor estate. And now you're coming back and saying the court never should have done that because the work was performed incompetently. And that's consistent with Baker v. Simpson. It is also consistent with the ABC Dentistry case that we filed, where it was not the debtor's counsel who was being sued. And it's consistent with the matter of Murphy case that we cite, in which it is once again not the debtor's counsel, which in the reply brief, appellant incorrectly states that it was. I'm happy to take any further questions from the court and otherwise just ask that the court affirm.
I wanted to ask one question in the hypothetical Judge Wesley gave you. So you would agree then that a lawyer who failed to file a claim and then was the subject of a malpractice action, that would not be arising.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. If this was a situation where the Avoca claims were barred because my client missed the claims bar deadline and did not file proofs of claims, that is a state court malpractice action. It does not impact the integrity of the process at all.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Haddad. Thank you, Your Honor. You've got 2 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. Picking up on the last point, among the elements of the breach that we are alleging is the failure to file proper proofs of claim, the failure to file amended claims, the failure to file a motion to set the value of the plaintiff's claims, the failure to inform the clients of the process set forth in the trust distribution proceedings, and ultimately taking on the conflicting representation of the member of the creditors committee. A contract that the defendants and plaintiffs, that the defendant signed, said they contracted to represent the interests of Mr. Walesky and the class, not to represent Mr. Carroll or the creditors committee generally.
Was he a member of the Avoca plaintiff class?
Yes, he is.
How is he conflicted with your client? His claims are the same. But under bankruptcy law, explain to me how he's conflicted with your client.
Under bankruptcy law, if you're put on a creditor's committee, you have a fiduciary responsibility to the case.
No, you haven't answered my question. Give me the facts of your factual allegations that how he is conflicted with Mr. Walensky. What is it about his claim that's different from Mr. Walensky's?
No, his claim is as a member of the class. The nature of his
personal claim is the same. He had creosote exposure, right?
Yes.
And Mr. Walensky had the same exposure, did he not?
Yes.
So then how is his claim conflicting with Mr. Walensky's?
Because his duty as a member of the creditors committee is to the bankruptcy estate, and Mr. Walensky's duty as the plaintiff's representative is to all the creditors exclusively of the Avoca claims.
So representing Mr. Walensky's interests
no,
with the other unsecured creditors suddenly makes him conflicted?
No, Your Honor, that he was not representing Mr. Walensky's, Mr. Walensky's interest. He was, his job on the committee is to represent creditors generally. That's the key distinction that all
Mr. Hadda, the cases. You are familiar enough with bankruptcy practice to know that when a representative creditor is put on a committee like this, as a practical matter, the first thing they're doing is protecting themselves and, because they owe a fiduciary duty, like you say, all the others who are just like them. That's why they're put on the committee, to represent those like claim holders, right?
Yes, but once they seek the benefits for themselves, then they're violating their duty on the committee. The purpose of the committee, as Your Honor knows, is to deal with the case as a whole, not just to get the best outcome for Mr. Walensky and the Avoca plaintiffs. It's to minimize the benefits paid to other parties. That's the job that the Montgomery firm signed up for, yet that's the job that they abandoned. And when we look in the jurisdictional context, because we can't say from a jurisdictional binary, you got jurisdiction or you don't. We don't look at the factors and say maybe this or and balance things. We say you have it or you don't have it. And when we look at the cases, the Second Circuit, the Baker case, and every case, because we addressed each of them in our briefs, the distinction in the cases is that those who represent estate professionals or deal with the court orders, such as debtor in possession financing or creditors committees, they're paid for, they're governed by the bankruptcy code, those claims arise in, and others do not. And that's the distinction
got $200,000 out of the estate.
That's a breach, Your Honor. The fact that they went and did this and took money from the estate breached their duty to the plaintiff. And
that's not the issue. The issue is it arising in the bankruptcy case?
No.
Right?
Those are all facts to be pleaded and proved in the underlying case. It is not to say it belongs in the bankruptcy court, because in every bankruptcy case, someone gets money, someone doesn't get money. Those are the facts. Those are not the jurisdictional determinants. What's the jurisdictionally determinative is the party, the nature of the claim, and the breach. And are they estate professionals? And will it actually impact the estate? And this most assuredly will not. It will not take one nickel out of the Mississippi plaintiff's hands. It will not impact the distributions to anyone. It will not impact the releases or any other outcome in the case.
What I'm concerned about is setting up a malpractice system that effectively second guesses bankruptcy cases. It's almost like you have a class action in a non-bankruptcy context, and then 4 years later, you have an absent class member saying, I got shafted by the class attorneys because they didn't do a good job and they could have gotten more money. And that attacks the class action process. That to me is a more analogous example than patent law.
Well, every malpractice case necessarily attacks what went on in the underlying case.
Right, but the question is how big and how directly does it? I don't think it's a hard and fast rule like you're suggesting.
Well, I think in this case, given the nature of the claim that's asserted here, the breach of contract, the abandonment of the own client's interest, that is a case that belongs under Pennsylvania law, because that's the contract that this law firm signed and committed to do. And when you do that and you don't perform the assigned tasks, whether it's in the bankruptcy court or the patent court or any other court, that is not something that arises in bankruptcy. And that's the case law distinction that we've seen in all of the cases throughout the circuits and the district courts.
Mr. Haddad, right. Would you not concede that the bankruptcy judge is likely a better judge as to whether there was malpractice in light of having overseen the bankruptcy?
That would be a question that you would have for every judge in every case.
I'm just asking that question. You would concede that, would you not?
I would concede that the bankruptcy judge would view himself that way. Yes, I would. I might argue that perhaps the bankruptcy judge is too close to the case because those are his own orders.
But if you go forward in Pennsylvania, is there a chance the bankruptcy judge is going to be a witness to explain what went on in this case and to explain why this was not malpractice, or why the harms were, there was no prejudice because the alleged ineffective counsel didn't result in any detriment to your clients?
Absolutely not. And here's why. Because we have the orders, and the orders say what they say. Those are facts. I don't need the judge's opinion as to what the order says, because I have the benefit of the order. That's a fact. What occurred in the case, that's a fact. That is not something that makes it necessarily sent to the bankruptcy court to decide.
Right, but what a jury would have to decide is whether or not there was malfeasance or misfeasance, whether there was there were errors, and what the consequences were.
That's correct. And the jury will see the contract. The jury will see the conduct. The jury will hear expert testimony as to what a lawyer who takes on a representation of one party does. If that lawyer violates its ethical responsibilities and takes on a conflicting representation without advising the client of what those risks might be. And like in any other case involving any other very technical or not technical issues at all, the jury will ultimately make the decision based upon the facts and the evidence, not what we're not calling the judge from Manhattan to drive on out to Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, and testify, because we got his orders. We could read those orders.
All right.
And that's the case in each instance. So we'd ask that that the case be remanded to Pennsylvania to undertake that very exercise.
All right. Yeah. Well, thank you both. Interesting case, well argued, and we will reserve decision, of course.